Welcome to The Good Stuff with Sonoma County Wine Growers Show. I am your host, Virginie Boone, alongside my co-host, Carissa Cruz, President and CEO of The Wine Growers. We're here to talk about what makes Sonoma County such a special place to grow, make, and enjoy wine. And Carissa, on that note, I mean, it's been a long harvest season.
It has.
What are you hearing from the farmers that you work with?
They are tired. I think it's mainly they are very, very, very tired. No, it's been a really interesting harvest. You know, it's been a long harvest. We've spent a lot of time talking about how typically, you know, harvest stretches out over a couple of months, because at least over the past 5-6 years, it's been a really early start to harvest. So starting in more like August, even late July last year, which was incredibly early. And this year we didn't really get going. I mean, there was like some early harvest stuff happening for sparkling really in like early to mid-September. But it wasn't until we kind of hit a little bit of that heat spike, and then all of a sudden like the push happened that last week in September, and then October has just been a mad dash. Mm-hmm. Like literally harvest has not been a marathon. It's been like what I like to say when I ran track. I was a long distance runner. My coach would punish me sometimes by putting me in like the 800, which is really a distance run, but you have to like sprint. So it's like a sprint distance. So I feel like that is the best way to think about this harvest, is like a sprint distance. Like it's been all hands on deck running, but for a shorter amount of time than you would normally get. So October was just cranking, you know, now in November, slowing down a little bit. I think there's still definitely some grapes out there. And but overall, like the quality is awesome. And I know we kind of say that every year. So sometimes
it feels...
But it often is true. And really, really, really outstanding quality. And, you know, I think we joke a little bit offline that, you know, we're out of the drought, which really helped this year. The vines loved the rain that we got in winter and the cool temperatures. So,
yeah. No, I mean, it was a remarkable season in that way for so many things that grow here. But I think all as mad dash as it was, and as long as it was, and as exhausting as it was, I mean, quantity and quality very high.
Yes.
And we kind of broke that cycle of hotter, hotter, drier, drier.
Yes.
And I think everybody can feel pretty good about that.
No, that part has just been great. And it kind of shows you what happens, or what maybe harvest is supposed to be like in under normal-ish conditions. I mean, there's really no average. I love, like, tell us the typical harvest. I'm like, ask the farmers. There isn't one, but they relate back. It's always amazing to me too. I love this when you ask the farmers, like, oh, this is like the harvest was in whatever, and they can go back like 30 years, and they mention this random year. I'm like, I barely remember like what I had for breakfast, let alone like how much rain happened in, you know, 1989 or 1995 versus 2005. So it's, but it's their business, right? Their livelihood. So
yeah, and they remember seasons. I mean, it's
totally
part of the skill set
seasons.
For sure.
Yeah,
And it gives them that adaptability, which is so important. But we are today going to spend some time with our guest, Samantha Cole Johnson. Sam has been here in Sonoma County, sort of spending a lot of time with farmers, talking about harvest, talking about what they do, talking about the vineyards. Sam has been writing for JancisRobinson.com since her Diary of a Willamette Cellar Rat series in 2019. So she's worked harvest, clearly. She's actually worked for harvest.
Yes.
So we'll have to ask her about that. She also teaches for the WSET from her home base in Portland, Oregon, and has been shortlisted for the Roederer International Wine Writers Award. More recently, she entered into the Master of Wine program, so we can also ask her about that. She's definitely very interested in the farming side. So
absolutely.
She's in the right place, right?
Yeah, it's been great. So she's been kind of touring around Sonoma County. She did a blind tasting, which I really want to talk to her about, because she literally tried 82 wines in one day. Mm-hmm. So I know this is something you're familiar with, but to me it's just like, smack me on the head. Like, how do you do that? Like, that's a lot. Although I very much appreciate the results and people like you and Sam who put so much attention into thinking and being really thoughtful and methodical about wine tasting and providing that feedback for kind of the broader community of wine lovers. But that's a lot to do. in a day. So
it is. It is. And I know I always joke because people always think, oh, you taste wine for a living. That must Yay. Be so fun. Like you're just sitting on your back, you know, patio yeah. right. enjoying wine and taking a few notes. It's like, no, it's a lot more rigorous than that. And
extremely.
The pros take it seriously. They start early.
Yes.
It's intense.
No, and like specific, like this is what I want for a palate cleanser. This is the water I want. This is the temperature. This is the order. I mean, all yeah. of that matters. It's a big deal.
It does. So we look forward to talking to her a little bit about that and so many other things when we come back.
Great.
Welcome back to The Good Stuff. We are here with our guest, Samantha Cole Johnson. And when we left you last before the break, we were saying how Sam has been here tasting lots of Sonoma County wines, spending a lot of time with grape growers and farmers and sort of figuring out what they do, as well as winemakers. So tell us a little bit about your role for JancisRobinson.com and what brought you specifically to Sonoma County.
So I am the U.S. senior editor, which means that I cover the entirety of the United States,
which is a lot.
Yeah, that's I was going to say, not small, not no. small at all.
Just a tiny little place.
And review wines, write pieces on different regions, and yeah, what else can, what do I do on a day-to-day basis other than taste wine, visit producers, write pieces on them? Write educational pieces on how I started was writing educational pieces on how wine was made in the form of harvest journals, and I still try and bring a bit of that into everything I write.
Yeah, which is is especially important to us. We like to talk a lot about the farming side and the grape growing side, and it is so important to the context of what goes into a tasting note, what you're tasting. What you're writing about, I think, in terms of travel or what other people should be paying attention to in a region. Do you have a sense yet? I mean, I know you're still here, you're still sort of digesting everything, but do you have a sense yet of what you want to convey about Sonoma County to your readers?
That it's awesome. Oh, wait, did I jump in and speak on her behalf?
Wait, Krista,
no, sorry.
I'm
sorry, that wasn't
that.
For me? No. Oh, never mind. Sorry, Sam. I'll let the experts speak.
When I travel to a region, it's hard to know what you will end up writing about. Mm-hmm. So the thread that I started pulling on yesterday was that this, and we were talking about it at dinner last night with quite a few growers, is that this is a relatively young region, not for the U.S. in general. California has more history than most of the West Coast, or, well, not the East Coast, but most of the West Coast in terms of wine growing. But there is history, and we're on the second generation now. So when I was visiting producers, I started with Ramey, and they're on second generation. And then I was, and even people who aren't on the second generation have this history tie-in. So I was at Ridge as well, and it's not the direct familial connection, but Shauna Rosenbloom came over from Rosenbloom and now is at Ridge. And the history of those properties are really intertwined. So that's very interesting to me. Oregon, which is where I'm based, and I was the Pacific Northwest specialist before becoming the U.S. senior editor, Oregon doesn't have, we're on the second generation, but you can't follow it quite as far back.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I was going to say, last night at dinner, it was very interesting. So we had dinner with a number of the grape growers, Steve San Giacomo, Duff Bevel, Marissa Ledbetter, Foster, Brett Monsell, Steve Dutton, Glenn Proctor. I think I got most of them. But it was really interesting because I asked them, kind of playing off of that, Sam, I asked them to go around and just give like, okay, let's, instead of all these one-off conversations, forcing them to kind of go around and say who they are, what their farming history is, their family history. And it's like everyone started off with like, I'm Gen 3, I'm G2, absolutely. I'm G5. And even Marissa Ledbetter, I was surprised because I always learned something every time, even though I've been in this role for years. Talking about like the first time she thought of herself generationally, she was like in her early teens. And that was when this was presented, or even younger than that, as a young child thinking about herself in a multi-generational family business, which... Yeah.
And that, the perspective from last night of G5, it's not G5 grape grower, it's G5 farmer.
Yes.
And then at some point, grape growing came into it. Whereas when you look at the Oregon wine industry, after Prohibition, I'm looking at people who did go up to start growing grapes. Mm-hmm. Here, it went from farming into a natural transition into grape growing. Mm-hmm. And it has been about the crop, and then it's become about the wine.
Yeah, I always say that's one thing that's really differentiated our region is that we were farmers first. So like a lot of these farmers were trying to figure out, how do I stay farming? And I used to joke, I'm like, well, what would you do if you weren't farming? Like, are you a farmer or a grape grower? And they're like, and I finally had to be like, would you put on a suit and go work at the local bank?
And
like,
they ran away from you very quickly.
Like, no, then I'm definitely a farmer, because if I weren't growing grapes, which I love, and I think they love the idea and the community and wine, but if they weren't doing that, they would figure out something else to farm, because they aren't going to go work at the bank. No offense, bank work is excellent. We need bankers, but that's not their jam.
As incredible as the farming aspect is, and as much as people love it, it was an interesting conversation to have about the economics of it and how intensive it is, and also how you have to grow a certain amount to make it economically feasible. And I was talking about the value add of wine. I was like, well, why don't you also make wine? And it's like, it's not the same. It's not who they are. And if you are more comfortable outside doing the viticulture portion of things, and then someone asks you to make wine, that's not the most comfortable thing to ask someone to do.
No, that's right.
Just like I think the farmers would tell you, they prefer not to have the winemakers try to grow the grapes for them.
Yeah. Yes, certainly.
Although I have met growers who have started to make some wine or been involved in that part of the process, and they do admit that it sort of makes them a better farmer. And I think winemakers who do have to do a little bit of the farming themselves also will say that they are better winemakers if they really do have a deeper understanding of their place.
It's that appreciation, too, of just that process on both ends.
Absolutely.
Like in the partnership, for
sure. And I do think that's something that Sonoma County has quite a bit of, that relationship is goes pretty deep and really understanding site.
Yeah. And I think some of the, because we do have some, you know, we were with Steve San Giacomo last night, and San Giacomo just started their wine brand in 2016. But Steve San Giacomo's not making the wine. Like, the family is still focused on the farming. They have James McVale they brought in as their winemaker. But I think they started to make wine because they were two things. One, very excited about certain blocks that they farm that they just have an incredible passion for and wanted to see kind of come to fruition in a bottle of wine the way that they thought it should, and the way their path and their process. And then two, also thinking about setting up, you know, there's three siblings, Mia, Mike, and Steve in the San Giacomo generation that are farming and managing the business right now. But they all have kids. And the notion of maybe our kids are going to want to do something beyond the farming. Maybe some will be interested in winemaking and some will be interested in farming. Wouldn't that be great to have all those options for that generation that's coming up? Which was sort of interesting too.
I think you also have to think of... it's not romantic, but the insurance benefit of it, because if you look at regions, Sonoma is amazing because it does seem like the community here is really strong and people trust each other. But if you look at what happened with Washington recently, there are a lot of growers who feed St. Michelle Wine Estates, and they just cut a massive chunk of their grower contracts. And now who suffers is the grower.
Right.
It's not the wine brand. And so as a grower, you have to have a lot of trust that there's going to be someone there making your wine, like keeping those contracts going. And if you are the person who is making that wine, there's a little bit more trust to that. But it sounds like from last night, there are a lot of very long-term contracts here, and people are leasing and leasing and leasing land and selling those grapes to wineries, and then eventually they're ending up buying that so they can continue to sell those grapes to wineries.
It's important. Yeah, it's important that they are able to do that and that you have a lot of diversity of who owns the land, right? It is big corporations in some cases, but it's also majority really small family farms.
Yeah, we figured out. I literally added this up one day because I was just curious and not quite bored, but thought it was a good data point. But we were able to figure out that still 95% of the vineyards are still family owned in Sonoma County.
That's
so
incredible.
Yes, Jackson family, but the Jackson family is literally a family business and they're still really engaged. And I think you're headed to La Crema later today, so you'll get a more deep dive into that really wonderful property. But that was really interesting to me because I knew it was high and I'd been given stats when I started, but you kind of wander through the ebbs and flows and we hear a lot about mergers and, you know, purchases being done. Like, are we still maintaining that family DNA in our vineyards? And we are. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, just a really great sort of filter or to think about the region too.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that goes back to the sustainability piece too, in that you had buy-in because people live there. They raise their kids there. They want to keep the land for generations. They want to keep it healthy, whether they stick to grapes or there's something else in the future. Yeah. And so I do think that that was part of the magic of that initiative because you knew you were in a community that would understand what you were talking about.
They still thought I was crazy, but fine. Once they got over that and said, we're doing a region-wide commitment, you did what? You committed me too. I didn't agree to this. I'm like, well, your board voted for that, so don't yell at me. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's the sharing of practices that happen on the farmer level. We talk about this a lot, where on the ag side, it's where it's not competitive. I mean, it is because you have a product you take to market, which is your grapes, and you have different partnerships, but there's no benefit, and actually sometimes it's detrimental, if you figured out a way to manage a pest in the vineyard, or you figured out a better irrigation technique, or some technology that helps you be softer on the land, or use less resources. There's no real benefit to keeping that knowledge to yourself. It's much better to actually share it, because then as a community, you're using less water, you're managing pests, you're figuring out how to better think about the land stewardship piece. And I'm fascinated, and you saw it a little bit at probably at dinner last night. It's like, you can't stop the growers from just like chit-chatting. It's like, I feel like I was back in my sorority days at college, because they like, as soon as they see each other, it's nonstop. Like, it's just, and even when they leave our meetings, they're out in the parking lot, like at their tailgates.
Right, talking
chatting,
forever.
Because they love talking and sharing what's going on, and that's like so foundational.
And to use that to elevate the quality too, elevates the entire region, because the reputation really is built on the region. It's not built on a single brand.
Right.
And you see, I actually get frustrated on the regional body end that some wineries or growers will leave their regional association because they've built a reputation. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't allow someone like me to come and see that person because I'll be on regional body funding. And then they're not part of the organization, which means my readers might want to read about that person. But they've done themselves a disservice when they did the region a disservice. And it's everybody rises and falls together, and you have to recognize that.
Yeah, and that's been the beauty of our organization, is working with all the growers. It's literally like we can cross every partner in the region because we work with all the farmers. So if they're buying grapes here and showcasing their wine from Sonoma County, we're excited to have them showcase their wine.
Yeah.
So I think it's really helpful.
So I'm curious, before we go into a break in a couple minutes, I'm curious about sort of the harvest that you have worked and what kind of drew you into wanting, I mean, you did a diary of a Willamette cellar rat, so you've definitely got cellar experience, but the harvest was also more in the vineyard, I would imagine. So have you done both?
I have done both. Actually, I've done 5 vintages, but the first 4 were exclusively in the cellar. Okay. And the last one was the first time that I worked from, I think it was April until the beginning of January.
Oh, wow.
And it was the whole growing season, and it makes such a difference, because when you see the entire year and then you go into the cellar and you get fruit in, and it's like, this is block D, and you know that block D was on a rocky hillside and it was struggling to set a lot of crop, and so you know why the clusters are straggly and there's not as much fruit. Whereas Otherwise, you're in the cellar, you receive fruit, it's like block D, and you go, oh, block D, and you shrug, and you continue doing whatever you're doing. Yeah. Or you might go, wow, those are really scraggly, wonder what happened. Right. And you just go on. And you don't actually have a concept, as much of a concept, of what the wine potential is. Mm-hmm. So it's very important, the vineyard to, to cellar aspect. I wish more wineries would insist that you start the year in the vineyard with them and go all the way through.
That's so interesting.
Because as you were saying, the appreciation for what viticulture does versus what enology does, it's a they feed into each other.
You know, and we found that, I know we need to go to a break soon, but we found that even we've been doing more and more of taking some of our vineyard employees, some of the frontline workers, and actually showing them wine production.
Yeah.
So they understand sort of the flip of what you're saying too, so they can see, like, we don't just drop off the grapes. Here's this incredible process that happens.
We're growing wine, not grapes.
We're growing wine. And and making that connection, I just think on both sides, is really important.
Yeah, and how it affects flavor and how a different block can taste, to your point. Like, why they were scraggly, what does that taste like?
Absolutely. And why it matters to do the sorting and not have leaves in the bin and you know, all of those small things during harvest too.
Okay, well, when we come back, we will continue our conversation with Sam Cole Johnson.
Everyone, welcome back to The Good Stuff. I'm Carissa Cruz, a co-host, and I'm here with Virginie Boone, the host, and our guest today, Samantha Cole Johnson. We call her Sam. So welcome back, Sam. And I was kicking off this session because I'm putting both our host and our guest on the spot today, because you both really, in your careers, do a lot of wine tasting. And we were just kind of chatting, why is wine tasting important, and how do you approach it? And Sam, I mentioned at the start of the show, you tried 82 wines blind on Monday in our office. Like, holy cow. How do you do that? What's the process? And Virginie, you have a steep background in that as well. So Sam, maybe we'll just start with you. Like, why does wine tasting matter, and how do you kind of approach it?
So I think it's important to realize that the relevance of criticism, and I do consider myself a writer before being a critic, but a critic is a very necessary part of this ecosystem, isn't actually the score. It's the accumulation of knowledge over years. There's very few people who go to a region year after year and they taste vintage after vintage after vintage. So I'm very young in my career. As I go on, it'll be much easier to view these in the context of the last decade. Right. And when you're at the store looking at a shelf talker and comparing a score, that's what I'm doing in the context of reviewing, is I'm comparing this wine to that wine to the other wine. And wine tasting, it's not subjective. And I think a lot of people would like to think that it is subjective and that it's all based on feelings and your thoughts and your personal preferences. There is a set of rules, and if there wasn't a set of rules, then there wouldn't be books written on this subject, and I wouldn't have a job. There is a set of rules, and this set of shared agreements, by learning them, you can become a better wine taster, and improve your tasting ability. So,
yeah. I would agree with all of that. I mean, I think it is important to take yourself out of it as much as you can, and think about your I always would think a lot about all the different readers that might take in a score, and the different preferences that people have, and the different body types that people have, and the different tolerance for alcohol that people have, or preference for sweetness, and not to dismiss things because I had another preference or I had another preconceived notion of something.
I think this is really important. So I also teach for the Wine and Spirits Education Trust, which is a educational program out of London, but runs classes here, WSET, teach level 3 and diploma. And I have a lot of students who are coming into more entry level, like entry into WSET 3, and we'll taste an oaked Chardonnay. This is the most common one. And they go, don't like oaked Chardonnay. Oaked Chardonnay is bad. Oaked Chardonnay is not bad. Yeah. You don't like it.
Yeah.
That's different.
Yeah.
And when
that's
you
a really good point.
When you view it in terms of these shared agreements, I would say, looking at them, one of them is balance, length, intensity, complexity. I'd add integration, typicity. These are things that you're looking for. So for me, I think Zinfandel, speaking of Sonoma County, is a beautiful grape variety. It does tend towards a little bit higher alcohol. I am a teetotaler, so at home, I might not be able to drink as much Zinfandel as I would like to drink. But in the context of reviewing, there are just some really gorgeous Zinfandels out there, and they're not going to score any lower because they're heavy in alcohol, and I can't go home and drink
them.
Right,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's also been a long time sort of bias and criticism of things that maybe don't age, shouldn't score as high. And I've always thought that was sort of ridiculous. I mean, if a wine is delicious and it's well made, to me, I think it still deserves a high score for its category, let's say. And yes, you want to talk about the ageability, you want to talk about the structure, you want to talk about the acid profile, but I do think it matters, you know, that wines that are not necessarily going to cellar for 20, 30 years also get their due.
This is a bugaboo for me.
I like that word, bugaboo.
Because it's true. And in the context of scoring for JancisRobinson.com, things that are ageable do score higher. Mm-hmm. And that's a shame. But I do think you view it within the context of the category. And you can have outstanding wines that aren't ageable or are only meant for the next year. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of what comes into it is, if you look at the building blocks of, so I mentioned balance as one of the things you would look for, as well as integration. And these are, balance and integration are different things. You can have, like, it's like a metal alloy, right? You mix one with the other. But if you didn't melt them down in the correct context, they're not going to be the alloy. They're just going to be two distinct metals. You can have tannin that's tannin and body, and if they're not well integrated, they can be balanced, but they're not integrated, and then they feel disjointed. But if you look at the building blocks of this, your sweetness, your tannin, your alcohol, your acid, your body, well, a lot of the things that that make a wine what it is in terms of ageability are structural components. And because we weight the structural components so well or so highly, I think that's why more age-worthy wines are scored higher, even though, man, a good rosé,
right?
that's within a year. There's just so much joy
yes.
to fresh wines that you can drink within the year. They're, in my mind, they are almost more fun. There's not as much of, you don't have to have as much of an event. You don't have to think about them quite as much in order to justify opening the bottle. You just open the bottle,
which is our whole theme of the good stuff. Just open the bottle, drink the good wine. We've come full circle.
Yes.
Amazing.
I like to reward joy. I mean, I think it's a very important component of wine. It's why we share it with people. We don't tend to drink it alone as much. You know, it is something that is social, something that celebrates a year, celebrates a community, celebrates the farming and all that goes into that. So, yeah, it's tricky.
So, but do you think for both of you, I mean, because you've written and you write for different publications, so there's sort of an expectation, though, of that if I'm looking at a score from Jancis Robinson and I know kind of what that palette is or what's important, then I have a sense. And I might say, great, I love that. Or no, it's these aged wines that I'm way too impatient.
So, I don't even think it's JancisRobinson.com. Yeah. I don't even think it's the palette of the publication. I think it is the individual palette, which is why it is such a shame when people take away initials at the end of a tasting note, because the person who reviewed is just as important as the wine or the vintage or anything else, because that person's palate may align with yours. And someone else's at the publication may not align with yours.
Yeah, that's
and
very
so
true.
As much as this is, there are a set of shared agreements, and tasting isn't subjective, how much you weight balance and integration may be different than how much I weight balance and integration. Mm-hmm. So when you taste a wine, that score might be different for both of us.
Yeah. Well, and I think increasingly there's fewer and fewer people who are tasting blind and who are kind of taking this, you know, this very serious kind of traditional approach to tasting. And so ideally, it doesn't matter what publication you're writing for. People trust that you have put the work in to really taste a wine with thought.
Well, we're going to have to go to a break, but you give us a great question. So I'm going to let you think while we're on break about what is the importance of blind tasting in the context of brand and storytelling and family history that you get as an average consumer when you pick up a bottle of wine. So you got a minute to think about that. We will be back after this break on The Good Stuff. Are back on The Good Stuff. This is Carissa Cruz. I'm here with Virginie Boone, my host, and our guest today, Samantha Cole Johnson from JancisRobinson.com. Sam, so, and Virginie, we were talking right before the break. I was asking you the most riveting question of the day to really dive into blind tastings. I think folks are fascinated, like, what is a blind tasting and how do you do it? And Sam, I know you did 82 wines in our office on Monday, so I have proof that it can be done. So maybe just talk about why you blind taste and kind of the value of that and how you do it.
So I think it's important to differentiate between a couple different types of blind tasting first, which would be you can blind taste for what something is, what the vintage is, what the variety is, where it's from. That's not the kind of blind tasting I was doing on Monday. The kind of blind tasting I was doing was, I don't want to see what the wine is. I know they're all from Sonoma, but there is an inherent bias to knowing a brand after you've done this for a while. Like, they have a great reputation. Maybe you know the person who made it. Maybe you like that person. Maybe you don't like that person.
Right.
But you can see it, like, as a consumer, when you go to the store and you see your favorite label, you grab that bottle, right? Or you go, oh, I heard this one was good. That's a form of bias, mm-hmm. saying, I know that brand usually produces good wine. Well, if you know that brand usually produces good wine year on year, and you see that label, then you're probably going to think already that that's a good wine. And that does influence how you taste that wine.
Yeah.
So I don't want that when I'm tasting. And in some cases, you can't avoid it. The rest of the week, I've been going around and doing visits. I do score those wines. I feel that I am being as fair as I possibly could be. But in the context of tasting a large amount of wines, I do like to eliminate that factor.
Yeah.
So it's not about what it is. It's about what I think of it, if I think it's a good wine, and taking away the bias that the label might provide.
Mm-hmm. Is there like a max, I don't know, I'm looking at both of you, like number of wines you can try in a day, or where your palate's like, no more, I need a beer or a cocktail?
I mean, my personal preference was no more than 24, and it would be a flight of 12 of one thing and then another flight of 12 of something different. Ideally, maybe red to start, and the second flight would be white. That was my ideal day. You can't always control these circumstances, and we get pulled into tasting competitions and things like that where, it's like it's wine number 200, and you kind of want to just slink away forever and drink a lot of gin and tonic.
And yet you get up the next day.
And then you say never again, lose my email. Yeah. So I ideally really liked smaller flights, but I had the luxury of being able to cover two specific regions that I happen to live in. And so wine was always coming in, and I could decide that to some extent.
And my preference would usually be fewer wines. Mm-hmm. However, I'm here.
You're in the region. Yeah.
And that makes it harder.
I don't love having people ship wines to me and have my living room become yes. central station for all of the cases. I also don't have the luxury in my house when those come in of being able to effectively blind taste them.
Yeah.
So I'm in the region. The wines are there.
Yep.
They haven't traveled. I can blind taste them. And the technical information can be put together by you guys.
Yes.
Which is very, very helpful. I don't have to go through all of that. So I figure I take advantage of it when I can. And yeah, you do start to get a bit of palate fatigue, and then you take a break and you go have lunch, you have some water, you come back when you feel like you're not fuzzy anymore. That was around wine 50, and then I left. And I came back and I did 32 more.
So we're going to have to take our last break, but quickly, because I know everyone wants to know, what toothpaste do you use? Because, and I'm going to ask both of you, because I think it's a thing if you're a blind taster and you try as many wines. So, Virginia, what do you use?
Sensodyne, and I also get a lot more teeth cleanings than the average person.
Sam?
We use the same toothpaste.
Of course you do. I feel like we have found our new sponsor of the show.
Non-whitening. Sensodyne.
Yes. Well, there you go. Well, you heard it here, folks. That is the magic toothpaste, Sensodyne, and we will be off to our break. Welcome back to our final segment of The Good Stuff, here with Virginie Boone and Samantha Cole Johnson from JancisRobinson.com, who's been in Sonoma County this week enjoying a lot of wine and meeting a lot of our characters, our cast of characters, farmers and vintners.
Including us.
Including us. Of course, including us. So in our final wrap-up, first of all, thank you so much, Sam, for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's been great to explore a little more how it works to do this crazy job you do. And we're really, really, really happy to have you both in Sonoma County and in studio today. And so we wrap up with our Tuesday night wine. And this is kind of the wine that you think you would be saving for a Saturday, but you don't, because you're supposed to be drinking the good stuff always. So, Virginie, I'm going to start with you. What are you drinking on Tuesday?
Well, I was lucky enough to taste a pretty new producer recently who is making the wine at Grand Cru Custom Crush, where a lot of small producers get a chance to make their wine.
Yeah.
The producer is called Cormorant, after the bird that has really large wings.
You can't
wings.
See, but she's actually making waving motions with her arms. So we're getting full picture here.
And I just love a kind of an interesting white blend. And this is Grenache Blanc and Marsan. It's 2021 vintage, and the grapes are from Preston Family, a great producer on Drake Creek Valley.
Awesome, Sam. You want to play along?
I will play along, but. This is my Tuesday night wine in 5 years.
Okay.
Because I would want to cellar it. It's not waiting for it to... It's not waiting to drink the good stuff. It's making sure that the good stuff is at its peak.
Perfect.
When I drink it.
The good stuff.
I went to Ramey earlier this week, and they showed me their 2020s, 2020 Chardonnays, and they are fantastic.
Nice.
Difficult vintage, and they made some really incredible... Chard, and the Hyde Vineyard in particular was
always amazing.
Beautiful.
Yep.
I also want to shameless plug here. It's not your expensive wine for Tuesday night, but we do have a wine of the week on JancisRobinson.com every week,
and you should follow along.
It's a value wine that punches way above its weight. So that's always fun to check into.
Mm-hmm. That is definitely a version of the good stuff. Well, I am going to round us out with my. Favorite varietal, essentially, which is just sparkling. I don't know if that can live alone.
Bubbles.
Bubbles. I did get my shipment from Iron Horse recently, and the fairy tale sparkling was in it. So that's what I'm pulling on Tuesday evening.
I sure hope so.
There you go. Well, everyone, thank you so much for joining us. It's been awesome. I've been able to do the interview because I have two wine reviewers in studio today. But again, Virginie, always great to see you. And Sam, great to have you here in Sonoma County. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. We will see you next week on The Good Stuff. Mm-hmm.